always be clear where you get your conservative talk.
The St. Louis Business Journal is now reporting that liberal billionaire George Soros is the largest shareholder of Odyssey,
the parent company of KMOX and 97.1 Talk.
Soros' maneuver raises critical questions about the future of media ownership and influence.
Money and attention is power. And when he has the money and he controls what's on the radio stations, he's going to be able to control the minds, essentially hundreds of millions of Americans.
St. Louis's trusted source and number one.
For conservative talk.
This is News Talk STL.
For podcast articles and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
When you think about the Joe Biden you saw in the debate, ask yourself a question. Do you think the guy who was defeated by the stairs, got taken down by his bike, lost a fight with his jacket, and regularly gets lost, makes it four more years in the White House? And you know who's waiting behind him, right? Vote Joe Biden today and Kamala Harris tomorrow.
I'm Donald Trump, and I approve this message.
Well, there's a very cute ad right there.
You gotta watch that. I wish I could see that. It's a very visual
commercial. I bet you it's funny.
And Chris, you got the Kamala cackle at the end.
Yes, gotta have the cackle.
Which highlights the Kamala problem they have, even if Joe Biden were to somehow step aside. Welcome back to the second hour. It's been a very quick show because we have a ton to unpack with all y'all. Welcome back to the Tim Jones and Chris Harp Show, 5:07 in the p.m. Central Time. It's July the 1st. Can you believe it? That means the Missouri August primary is a mere 5 weeks away. Yes, 5 weeks away. We are 36 days away from determining five of our six statewide offices, because let's be honest, the August primary is likely going to determine every single one of those offices, every single House seat, and half of the state Senate, including an open congressional district.
And Tim, as a former legislator and Speaker of the House, correct me if I'm wrong, is this the first day of the new fiscal year for the state of Missouri? Is it July 1st?
You are correct.
And what happens today?
We start to spend 50 plus billion dollars of your taxpayer money. Yes. Yeah. The new fiscal year, as Chris pointed out, it's a great catch there. Yeah. It's, the fiscal year ended on June the 30th. The new 50.5 billion dollar budget goes into effect today. I will say there's a sliver of good news. It's slightly lower, believe it or not, than the budget from last year. Huh. Thanks to the work of Cody Smith and members of the Freedom Caucus.
Now, the governor's saying that he is, quote unquote, he has, quote unquote, slash pet projects, and that's why the budget is more in a line. You know, Bill Eichel.
Can I just say something about that? Yeah. The governor's full of crap, because guess what his budget was, Chris? $53.5 billion. It was $3 billion higher. He wanted to spend more money.
You know, Bill Eichel educated me today on something on the Bible, and I was when he was on the Vic Porcelli show this afternoon. And I know, you know, we talk about $50 billion, but a lot of that money is government grants and things of that nature. That I think he was saying that the general budget that we take in from the state from taxes and fees and all that's like $13 billion, but the governor's budget on that spending is $14 billion, which means technically the budget is not in alignment, or is it, Tim? Explain that to me.
So, Chris, it depends on your definition of is, right?
Right.
I mean, unfortunately, you know what? I would blame the governor for this as well. You don't have to take the federal money, and many states rejected it. I believe DeSantis has rejected a ton of federal money, because here's the problem. When you take that federal money and you don't make it for just one-time spending, guess what happens? Next year, a lot of times, Chris, the feds back out, and you got to come up with that money yourself.
Yeah.
Guess how you do that? You either slash other services or spending, or you raise taxes. Chris,
or those programs will have a short period of time too, like 3 to 5 years or something, and it runs out.
If it's got a sunset on it, yeah. Right. Here's my problem with all the spending. When I left the legislature barely a decade ago, it was not the Stone Ages. It wasn't a million years ago. Our budget was only $27 billion. You explain to me how a state like Missouri, which has not experienced a large population increase goes from 27 billion to over 50 billion in less than 10 years.
Tim, what would you say to people? And I'm serious. I'm just playing devil's advocate here when I say this. What would
because these are complicated subjects.
What would you say to people who would say, okay, the state budget has grown significantly since you have left office. That was 10, 12 plus years
ago. 10 years ago.
What would you say to people who make the equivalent? Look, I was working at this job and I was making $50,000 a year. Now I've got a better job. Things have gone better for myself. I'm making $75,000 a year. My spending is probably going to go up because I'm bringing in more revenue. Can people make that argument? It's like, look, the state is bringing up more revenue. Maybe it's becoming more attractive for businesses. It's becoming more prosperous. Then that budget should rise commensurate with the receipts that are coming in.
That's a good argument. However, there's a formula that a lot of more conservative economists use, Chris, and they say cost of living plus population growth. Cost of living plus population growth. There is no way that our budget in a state that has experienced only about 1.7% in increase in population growth should have nearly doubled its budget. Because let me ask
you. Have we had prosperous businesses have come in and like, wow, yeah.
Nope.
Thank God such and such industry came in here. Look at all the jobs they've brought in. Look, the revenue they've brought to the state budget. Have we had any industries that could affect it that much?
No, because a lot of industries have left. And tell me what all of this additional government spending. So the Democrats always say, oh, after 20 years of Republican rule, things are just horrible in Missouri. Everything's horrible. How is everything horrible when you've doubled your budget in 10 years? You can't have it both ways.
Well, here's what they'll say. You know? They'll say that, yeah, the spending has come up, but us mean Republicans, we're not spending it in the right places. We're not spending it on crime prevention. We're not spending it on kids. We're not, you know, they'll say, yeah, we're spending the money in the wrong places.
But they'd be wrong because the education budget alone has increased over $5 billion in 10 years. It's the cost of increase to the budget and the government spending has greatly outpaced population growth and cost of living expenses. So here's the problem, Chris. The more dollars that Missourians are forced to put into government, guess what? It's not that money grows on trees and it just increases everywhere. It's a finite game we're dealing with here. So every dollar you put into the budget of the government is one less dollar that's in the private sector. So I would argue that in Missouri government is doing more and the private sector is doing less. How about Medicaid expansion? Mm. One of the biggest cost drivers of the budget, the two biggest cost drivers of our budget, the increase over the last 10 years of the $25 billion increase in 10 years has gone to Medicaid expansion.
How do you correct that now that the voters have voted into the Constitution that we need to spend more resources on Medicaid?
You reform the program. Mm. You reform the eligibility because, Chris, guess what that did? It put more able-bodied working class, you're an eyes age, working class people.
Young people?
Young people. Okay. Young strapping lads. Well, Joey puts up a meme every day that shows you and I like we just got out of
exactly.
Planet
I'm like,
Fitness.
Man, I wish I had that body.
I did lift weights today. So that's the problem, Chris, is you've massively expanded that program and you've increased education spending. We are spending more money in this state per capita than ever on education. The foundation formula is fully funded, and we're spending more money on transportation for schools than ever before. Guess what our test results are doing? They're going down.
Where is that money really going in education? I remember when we were getting the COVID money, and a lot of that money was supposed to be going towards improving schools, ventilation systems and things for COVID, but also tucked in there that a lot of people didn't know, that money was also shoring up Chicago's pension systems, and that's something they fought for, and that was happening all over the country. So where is the majority, where is the majority of this massive expense of spending of education money going? Is it for teachers? Is it for classrooms?
No. The places you mentioned, it's not going to teachers and to classrooms. It's generally going to the administrative state. Chris, have you ever, I did this recently because my daughters, one of them just graduated high school, one of them's in high school. You ever picked up the directory from your local high school and looked at all of the administrators that work there? You've got principals, deputy principals, associate principals, assistant principals. It goes down every single classification class you can think of. I don't know how many administrators we have per student these days, but the number has risen meteorically. Chris, as government expands, what does government do? It spends all of its, every year, it spends all of its money, because if they don't spend all their money, then they can't ask for more the next year. And you know how it is on the federal government. I'm sure you and Senator Talent talked about this all the time. A cut in government language is not giving agencies more money next year. They keeping the money the same is considered a cut, right? Mm-hmm. So everybody else, everybody in government gets a cost of living increase, but not Missourians. I doubt anybody. Yes, some people have probably done really well over the last 10 years. I doubt most of the majority of Missourians have nearly doubled their income, because the budget has nearly doubled. It went from $27 billion to $52 billion that the governor proposed this year in 10 years. I doubt most Missourians have doubled their salaries in 10 years along the same way.
You have.
No.
I'm just kidding.
I had to think about that for a minute. I only made $36,000 as a legislator. So yeah, doing a little better. We're very blessed. Those are great questions though, Christian. You know what? I am not the budget guy. I kind of have to fumble through that. I know enough about the budget to be dangerous. We should get somebody like Cody Smith on here, who's running for treasurer, or Dirk Deaton. Yeah. Dirk Deaton's the advice. Dirk Deaton's a brilliant young man. Or we could get Scott Fitzpatrick, our state auditor. You know what? We'd be safest with Scott Fitzpatrick because he's not running for anything this year. Yeah. And we could have him on. He could explain the state budget.
But that has been always one of my questions is, you know, you hear about the debate, the budget, it's grown, blah, blah. Well, you know, I spend a lot more money than I did when I made 25,000 years, a 20-year-old kid, than what I make now, and my salary's gone up, so I'm going to be spending more money naturally if I'm taking in.
No, you're right.
More money.
No, you're right. You're right. But it should not be double exponentially. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like it's gone up at a meteoric level because people are saying, whoa, what services am I getting for this? Mm. Folks, we got a lot to get to this afternoon. As you can tell, Susie Moore is going to be in studio with us. We're so blessed to have Susie here today. She filled in for Tony Colombo while he's down in the land of the mouse, the house of the mouse.
Florida.
Yeah, huh? And we're going to talk to Susie Moore, deputy managing editor at redstate.com. Lots of great stories up at Red State. We'll talk to Susie about those, her reaction to the debate last week, and more. Without further ado, though, while time is ripe, we better get to today's speaker's stump speech.
Listen to me.
I'm very consistent. I'm a very stable genius.
It's time for the Speaker's Stump Speech, sponsored by Hanson's Tree Service at hansonstree.com.
What was the title of today's speech? Oh, yes. Blue State Liberals, I should add Blue State Left-Wing Liberals, making life unaffordable for Americans' families. Yeah, so my whole point of today's, I think all the talk about Joe Biden, the person not being able to manage things for the country because of his age and his that's a useful excuse for some on the left right now. Not all of them, because they're kind of circling wagons in certain areas. But I also want to focus on the fact, don't let the media get away with this. It's also the policies. See, they just want to send the messenger out to pasture so they can protect the policies, right? That's what they got to do. They got to exile Biden to protect all the blunders that he's made. But it's all, look, whether it's mentally challenged, cognitively challenged Biden, or whether it's greasy Gavin Newsom, or whether it's one of these young, up-and-coming young bucks in the Democratic Party, they all would have adopted and promoted and promulgated all of the policies of Joe Biden, and nobody could have argued about the cognition of Whitmer or Wes Moore or Gavin Newsom or J.B. Pritzker. They would all be doing the same things. So let's dive into a little bit about the fact that over the last few years, especially in recovering from the Fauci flu and the pandemic, the plandemic years, what has happened in blue state America? These are the policies that Joe Biden wants to adopt and all of his handlers want to adopt for the rest of the country. If you want to afford... Oh, the article is from the Washington Examiner. The Washington Examiner, Tom Joyce, writing yesterday on the fact that blue state liberals make life unaffordable for their blue state families. If you want to afford to raise a family, living in a blue state is a bad idea, according to a new report, not from the Washington Examiner. All you liberals are listening, you're going, the Washington Examiner. They always like to shoot the messenger, right? And they avoid the message. The report is from your beloved NBC network. Yes, from CNBC, the business news network of NBC. So this is everything I'm going to tell you was simply re-reported by the Washington Examiner. The five most expensive states for a family of four to live in are solidly Democratic, the report found. You can thank Democratic politicians in Massachusetts, Hawaii, Connecticut, New York, and California. If I would have asked you to pick five states out of thin air, many of you would have said many of the five I just mentioned, right? Why is that? Well, because we intrinsically know that those states are bad states to live in. Not because they're not beautiful. I mean, for the love of all things, California, Hawaii, these states should be swimming in people. People should be flooding in there. But they're flooding, well, with the exception of the illegal aliens, they are flooding outwards. They are all making life unaffordable for working class Americans. White liberals in the federal government. Oh, this kind of dovetails from the conversation Chris and I just had about the Missouri budget. White liberals in the federal government contributed to the problem by exacerbating inflation with wasteful spending. State and local governments also needlessly make life more expensive for their constituents. Each of the 10 states with the highest average state and local tax burden in the country has a democratically controlled state legislature, while New York and Hawaii top the list, according to, once again, not Fox News, but the nonpartisan Wallet Hub. When you let people keep more of the money they make, they won't need to make as much to survive. Taxing people at high rates, and this perfectly dovetails from the conversation Chris and I just had. Taxing people at high rates and spending all that money does not guarantee they'll get worthwhile services in return. Get this. New York City, for example, provides illegal immigrants with prepaid debit cards. That's where some of your tax dollars are going in those states. And like Massachusetts, puts them up in long-term hotel and motel stays on the taxpayer's dime. I hope that's not going on in Missouri, but do we really know? There was a report that came out last week that said there's over six, at a bare minimum, there's at least 60,000 illegal aliens in Missouri. Who's taking care of them? Likely the Missouri state government. While states such as Florida do crack down on illegal immigrant spending, cutting spending on illegal immigrants using Medicaid in about the past half year, California, on the other hand, has been offering free, right? Like anything's free. Health insurance to many illegal immigrants starting this year. People will have less money to pay for their health insurance if they're paying for illegal immigrants' health care with both their tax dollars and their premiums. Doesn't that just make sense? The article goes on and on to talk about more and more examples of where states are catering to people who aren't even citizens, raising tax dollars and spending taxpayer money like it's going out of style. Blue states, the Washington Examiner concludes that blue states should prioritize reducing the cost of living for families, even if it means embracing practicality and pragmatism over liberalism. As costs worsen, many people will have literal choice but to move elsewhere. And folks, if you read the U-Haul statistics every year, that's already happening. As per capita, people are flooding out of Illinois, New York, and California at much, much, much higher rates than anywhere else in the country. And the net inflow is heading to the South, the Southeast, and the freedom and liberty loving West. And that's the Speaker Stump Speech for today.
You know, and one thing that's really amazing or funny to me
Ironic?
Ironic, there you go. Is, you know, they're starting to gear up the 2025 debate. Everyone is getting their proposals and out and everything. And you remember during the 2018-17 Trump tax cuts, they eliminated the SALT deduction, the state and local tax deduction, for high wage state or high tax states like New York, New Jersey, California. They were up in arms when they eliminated that. And that's one thing that the liberals are in these high tax states are fighting once again to get that deduction, back, enacted. It's almost weird is because, you know, they're crying and this is a horrible thing. They're like kind of admitting that taxes are too high, aren't they?
Or am I missing something? They are, Chris. They're using that deduction to take a deduction from the federal tax. They're using the high state taxes as a deduction against the federal taxes. And people are going, wait a minute. You're just using one subsidy to pay off a high tax burden for another. Yeah. You're absolutely correct. Yes. Well stated indeedy. All right. We got to get to a break here. Susie Moore, deputy managing editor at redstate.com. What did Susie think of the debate debacle? And What's going on at Red State? We'll have that discussion and more when we return on the Tim Jones and Chris Harp Show, 101.9 94.1 News Talk STL.
For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
So now, after Thursday's abysmal debate performance, President Biden finds himself at rock bottom again. It was bad. My family and I, as you know, have known this man for decades, and his family as well. And yes, I know them personally. And I still believe in Joe Biden. I've learned that counting him out is always a mistake, and doing that now could be catastrophic for our country. I'll also say America needs an explanation from Joe Biden and reassurance that the other night was a one-time event and not part of a larger problem.
So sad. Mika's MSNBC's Mika's says we just have to soldier on.
Fair and balanced, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the thing that the Democrats are still trying to pull the wool over our eyes, they know what we saw was not a cheap fake, as they call it, but they're still trying to pull the wool over our eyes because they won't admit that Biden is not going to get any better. Mm-hmm. This is not a bad debate performance, and he just needs to bone up a little more next time and get a little more rest and a little couple of more B6 shots, and he'll be fine. No. He's not going to get better between now and September yep. and the next debate.
It's not like he had a broken leg or something.
Exactly. Yeah. He's not going to get any better.
Well, let's see what our next guest thinks about that and so much more.
Oh, Suzy Q, baby, I love you.
Suzy Q.
I'm the boss.
That's
how about
right.
that?
Yes, indeedy. Oh, Suzy Moore.
Sorry.
Suzy Moore in studio with us, Deputy Managing Editor at Red State, redstate.com, at Smoozy Q on Twitter. Suzy, your reaction, your perception, your thoughts about the debate debacle of Joe Biden from last week, and what do you think the Democrats, well, we know what they want to do with him, but that's easier said than done, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Definitely easier said than done. My initial reaction to it, of course, was, you know, we were watching it at Red State. We had a live blog going on, and yeah, I was expecting to see what we've been seeing from Joe Biden for a long time, which is that he's just not on his game. So I was expecting him not to have a stellar performance, but I thought they might have him prepared and juiced up enough that he was, you know, kind of akin to what he was like at the State of the Union.
Mm-hmm.
And within the first couple of minutes, I was like, oh my gosh, mm-hmm. like this is bad. This is really, really bad. And, you know, that persisted throughout the night. And there was actually some humorous moments, but it's sad more than anything else just to watch, you know, setting aside your politics or whatever. It's sad to see somebody, you know, declining in that way. Mm-hmm. And definitely it's sad for our country to think that the person that is at the helm of it is just not capable. So, you know, I was sure there would be fallout. There, of course, has been fallout. And I think it's one of those things where, you know, you've got the faction of people that are just like throwing their hands up like that. We can't do this. We've got to get a replacement. And then there's the ones that are like, oh no, we'll find a way. It'll be all right. And then the ones that are just still trying to gaslight everybody that he's fine. And, you know, I said this, I think in one of the articles I wrote yesterday was, you know, every candidate in a race vows up and down every which way. They are not getting out. They are in it for the long haul. They are there, 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 there until the last minute when they say, oh, we're getting out.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we're going to be faced with, really, from the Biden camp until the moment comes where they decide that they're going to no longer be part of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Got it.
You know, Suzy, I always like to say on Monday that I watch the Sunday shows, so you don't have to.
Right?
Did you watch the Sunday shows yesterday to get a chance of them?
No.
Well, you know, usually we talk about they have a current common theme that mm-hmm. you hear all the surrogates basically saying the sure. same thing. Well, they were in full damage control on Sunday, and the one thread, of course, was that Donald Trump, that President Biden just had a bad night. He's going to get better. But here's the one here that because I listened to the podcast instead mm-hmm. of watching. I almost drove off the road when I heard them saying this, especially Maryland Governor Wes Moore. Suzy, they are saying with a straight face that Joe Biden is the only Democrat that can beat Donald Trump in the election this year. And that is the reason they have to stick with him, because he has a history, a track record of beating Donald Trump, because he's done it before. But they're saying that's why they have to stick with him, because he's the only one. No other candidate they have can beat Donald Trump. They say that with a straight face.
Well, how bad do they think they are?
It's amazing. And it wasn't just one. I mean, they were saying that Chris Coons, the senator from Delaware, saying the same exact thing. He's the best candidate we have.
They don't think that Gavin Newsom or J.B. Pritzker or Gretchen Whitmer or Wes Moore or somebody has a chance against Donald Trump. What does that say about them?
It does. And two, I watch these shows. I always talk about how Margaret Brennan is one of these really aggressive, always fact-checking. I got to give it to Margaret Brennan. She was fact-checking the Democrats on her show this Sunday. It's like, look, you people have been trying to tell the American people that Joe's fine and he's all that. You can't put this past the American people anymore. They have seen what they've wanted to see. And she was challenging them. It was almost like, oh, my God, the media's fair or trying to
be.
But I know she was just mad more than anything. She wasn't really caring about being unbiased.
Right, right. Yeah, they're kind of stuck now. They can't. If they want to try and retain any ounce of credibility, they can't pretend like they didn't see it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Susie, you have been doing Yo Woman's work on the Supreme Court coverage at redstate.com, and you have a new piece out today, hot off the presses, available at redstate.com, the Skinny on SCOTUS, July 1st, 2024 edition. Immunity has entered the chat. Susie, this was a landmark decision, and while the left is losing their minds on this, the morons at MSNBC and the communists at CNN don't realize this is actually a good decision for all presidents. And Joe Biden may benefit from this when Donald Trump goes back to 1600 Pennsylvania, because Trump won't be able to prosecute Biden under this mostly as well, right? They don't understand that we should not be prosecuting former presidents just because they're now our political opponents, right?
Right. No, I mean, I'm actually shocked at the freak out that we're seeing from the left about this decision, because while it does, you know, there's some things good about it for President Trump, it's not a slam dunk. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lower court's still going to look at the acts that he's accused of and determine which were and weren't official acts. And the ones that weren't, he's not immune from. And a lot of what was alleged in Jack Smith's petition or complaint against him or charges against him, I think the lower court's going to probably decide doesn't fall within official conduct. So, I mean, he'll end up appealing that again. But this is not a slam dunk win. It is a win for Trump in some ways. But it's a win for the presidency, too, because...
In general.
Chief Justice Roberts acknowledges this in his opinion up front. He says, look, this has far-reaching effects because you're talking about this particular office. And it's not about this particular president. It's about all the presidents and what we can, you know, how far... You have to give them some degree of latitude within the powers that the Constitution grants them, or else the separation of powers don't exist.
It's almost as if the left is mad that they've lost their lawfare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and they haven't. That's the thing. The cases against Donald Trump aren't just going to evaporate now. I mean, there's going to be parts of them that might get knocked out, but they've still got them. Yeah.
Susie, as a recovering attorney and a practicing journalist, I want to get your opinion on this quote from the New York Times, Charlie Savage, on the Assange deal. Mm-hmm. He said, quote, "The agreement means for the first time in American history, gathering and publishing information the government considers secret has been successfully treated as a crime." Your thoughts as an attorney and journalist on Assange?
Is this really the first time it's... I know, because so in order for him to be released, he basically pleaded guilty to what they were accusing him of, and I think most of that was under the Espionage Act. And I know that's different from how the Pentagon Papers were handled.
It's not a gotcha, because it's serious. I have been trying to wonder is there a difference?
I mean, I think that there are some strong arguments for why Julian Assange shouldn't have been charged the way he was charged, and I understand some of the concerns that were raised in relation to that, but I think you've got, you know, basically the freedom of the press and First Amendment butting up against the interests of the government and protecting certain secrets, that sort of thing. The bottom line is they all work for us, and unless and until it's directly impacting national security, I think there should be more transparency. So I tend to lean towards saying that Assange shouldn't have been treated the way he was.
Should he be convicted of a crime?
Well, he pleaded guilty to it.
I mean, but should he have?
Right. I don't know that he should have ever been charged. Okay. Again, he was the publisher of it. He wasn't necessarily the gatherer of it, and that's different. But
now they say that he can't. That he worked with this other cat. I can't think of his name.
Chelsea Manning,
whatever the hell he is now. That he worked with him to write code or whatever to help him break into these systems.
I don't think he actually did that. I think they had a discussion about whether he would.
Okay.
But I don't know that there's... I'm not 100% on that, but I don't know that he actually ever actively took any steps along those lines.
Okay.
And I think it was more about Manning saying that he wanted... Because it was Bradley at the time. He wanted access.
Confused.
Right, I know. It's Chelsea now. But at the time this all happened, Bradley was a boy.
Carumba.
But he wanted to be able to access the files without using his own identification.
Right.
So he was trying to figure out a way to access files that he already had access to, but not make it obvious that it was him accessing it. And I don't know. Again, I don't know enough about the specifics to say for sure how much Assange did. I think it's weird the way this case was treated by the mainstream media because like Assange was the hero of the left until he became critical of the Obama administration.
Probably wasn't.
And then all of a sudden he was like public enemy number one and they're like, kill him. So it is kind of fascinating. And I don't know when it or if we'll ever hear his side of the story because I think part of his deal with them was basically shutting up.
If, Tim, if I may have a quick follow-up, how long do you give Assange to be here on this earth? Because I think they wanted him free so they could give him something where he has a heart attack or assassinate him.
They could have just Epstein'd him, so right. I think having him free makes that less likely. But
he's going to go to a desert island.
No, my understanding is that part of the agreement was that he's going to have to be kind of measured in what he... speaks of publicly. I don't know.
Susie Moore, Deputy Managing Editor, RedState.com, host of the More to the Point Commentary here at News Talk STL, frequent host and contributor to all of our programs. Susie, the another story you wrote about was right after the debate last week with the CBS post-debate poll numbers, which painted a grim picture for Biden.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask you, you know, so the media's reaction, I want to ask you about, as someone who's in the media, along with the rest of us, are you a bit shocked at how much power the media thinks they have? Like, these are media people, CBS, NBC, and it's not just the commentators. They're all saying things like, Joe Biden should step down. Like, they have the power to do that. It just seems they should be reporting the reaction in the news and not telling the Bidens what they should be doing. It seems like it's almost it kind of proving the point that the media is part of the apparatus of the left these days.
I think the line between media and advocacy has really blurred. And I'm probably in a glass house saying that because I write for Red State.
But you don't pretend to be, I mean, everybody in our world admits their biases.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we are of the right. I mean, we are a right-leaning website. That's what we do. And on this radio station, we talked about things generally from the conservative perspective. But I feel like, you know, yeah, that line has been blurred. So you don't have just straight reporting from the legacy media anymore. You have kind of, you know, it's like the op-ed page has kind of taken over everything they do. And it does kind of leave you in a weird spot because, you know, if you just want straight reporting, where do you get that from?
Mm-hmm. Or even honest reporting.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You go to redstate.com.
Well, absolutely. We'll be honest with you. You may not agree with us, but we'll be honest.
Susie, another case that came down today from the Supreme Court is Corner Post versus Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve. Mm-hmm. And I think this was a win for free enterprise and for corporations. The justices ruled 6-3 to expand the statute of limitations for companies to sue over federal regulations, allowing more retroactive challenges to longstanding rules. So that's a victory for business, isn't it?
It is. And this was kind of a weird one. To me, it was almost like common sense, duh.
Yeah.
In this case, the agency passed a rule like in 2011, and then the business didn't even exist then. They didn't even come into existence until 2018. And then they were like, hey, this doesn't seem right. And they wanted to challenge it.
Yeah.
And because it was more than 6 years after the rule had been enacted, the agency said, no, you're out of time. So this is basically the court saying, if someone doesn't exist yet, they can't be injured by what you did. So it starts when they're actually injured. What's interesting, though, that's a 6-3 decision. The three dissent were the liberals on the court, and they were like spitting mad over it. And I'm like, what are they so mad about in this case? This isn't the immunity case. Why are they so mad? I haven't had a chance to read the dissent yet. But it's like fascinating to me that they're so mad about this.
And when you describe that case, I had heard this before. Mm-hmm. Like, and it was like, how in the world can you like retroactively go back and say, well, we're going to charge you for this for a business that's not even in existence? Are you kidding me?
I'll tell you what. This term at the Supreme Court has been major big for
big
like reining in the regulatory state. So I'm all about that.
Would you say, and I know you're not a court historian or everything, but would you say this court has done the most to be pro-business per se than any recent courts?
I mean, I think they've made some very consequential decisions that affect not just the business environment, but also like First Amendment and that sort of thing. So, I mean, I think
this has church been and religious rights.
Exactly.
Too.
So I think this has been a very consequential court, but in a good way. Of course, I'm coming from the right perspective of that. But I mean, the bottom line is they're trying to pull everything back to adhering to what the Constitution says.
Originalism.
Yes.
Susie, got a more to the point commentary coming out sometime this week? Have you thoughts on the subject?
I haven't come up with one yet. I haven't been like great about getting them done regularly because I've been so with consumed with SCOTUS stuff. So I'm hoping to get back to them. You know, Wednesday I might have one because it's, you know, we'll be coming up on the 4th of July.
I do take that personally.
When I know, Joey. I always feel so bad.
Susie, I do have a question for you. I was listening to our guy. Who does, I can't even think of his name, our heritage guy. Zach Smith. I was listening to the podcast and they were discussing a case that Justice Kagan had ruled on. And they were saying that she always tried to say that she was a quote unquote textualist, but the certain case that she ruled on recently proved adamantly that she was not. What is a textualist in concerning the Constitution? What does that mean?
So now you're going to get outside my comfort zone. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there was a point in time where we learned the difference between originalism and textualism and that sort of thing. And I'd have to go back and look at the decision and kind of understand better understand the context. I mean, I think obviously it's what it sounds like. It's basically tying the decisions to what the actual text says. Maybe not going back to the setting of the time and what it really meant in that context, but just looking straight at what it says and only at what it says.
Mr. Speaker, you have thoughts on that, Mr. Barrister?
On the
textualism,
what exactly does that mean in terms of the Constitution?
Yes, it's an originalist philosophy. So you take the words as they're presented and you try to apply what the original meaning was, you know, the textualism, you know, versus taking the words and trying to make them into something to fit your activist ideology in today's world.
So is textualism and originalism basically the same word? Can they be used interchangeably?
I think there's a Venn diagram in which they overlap.
There you go.
I would definitely agree with that. They're not exactly identical, Chris, but an example would be people would say, well, you know, under the Second Amendment, people could not, it never says that they could own cannons back in the 1700s. Yes, they could. And yes, they absolutely did. And cannons were some of the highest firepower of the air. So if people want to have machine guns nowadays, they should be allowed to do that as well. The textualism would mean, you know, what was the original intent?
Okay.
What was the original intent? So it's kind of how we get to that point.
Boy, what a class on constitutionalism we have here with Susie Moore. Thank you, Susie.
Who knew?
If you need more of that brilliance, you can follow her at SmoozieQ on Twitter, and you can also find everything that Susie and her colleagues write at redstate.com. Susie, thanks for all the great work you did throughout the debate and on the Supreme Court analysis. We love reading that stuff every day.
Thanks for having me.
And she's been working hard doing these shows, Vic.
Yeah.
And everybody, when these court decisions coming down, you've been on call.
I have been on call.
And
I like
Joey,
that.
Joey, we've just proven the point that because Susie didn't break any of the microphones, it must have been Katie.
It is definitely Katie. She's got a vendetta against us.
All right. We'll be back with Chris and I and Joey to help wrap things up. Chris Scott's Deck of Stuff and Larry Connors USA coming up at 6:05. We'll preview that as well for you when we return on the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show, 101.9/94.1 News Talk STL.
For podcast articles and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
When you start speaking in a language that people don't speak, they resent that. And if you start speaking like NPR, you're going to lose votes. I just don't like the term communities of color. I don't know what the hell it means. So I live in New Orleans. So they got three guys on the street corner. I said, hey, fellas, how are things in the community of color today? They said, what the f*** talking about?
Seriously, James?
Bastard out of here. All right? Address people like they address each other. And it's what I call coastal condensation, that we know what's best for you. Don't eat hamburgers. Don't watch football. Don't drink beer. Guess where our young male number is going? In the toilet. All right? because Democratic messaging, I'm sorry, is too feminine. It just is.
5:52 on the Tim Jones and Chris Arp show. James Carville. Wow, he came up with the slogan, the famous slogan, it's the economy, stupid. And he's got some very good advice there for the Democrats. They probably will not follow it, but there's nothing he said there, Tim, I can disagree with.
He's right, Chris. And he and Bill Clinton came from the school of master communication, right?
Yeah.
And even though I don't agree with their policies, like Reagan, like Trump, they know how to communicate with normal people. They don't talk in this highfalutin elitism of the coastal cities. And he's right. Who in the world walks around going, how's things in the community of color? he's got a really good point there. Talk to people where you find them.
Exactly. Seems like politics 101, but who knows? You know, I talked about during the show here how on the Sunday shows they seem to be reading from the same hymnal. One was that Joe Biden just had a bad debate, but he can be fine in the next debate. Just cut him some slack. There was another talking point, Tim, number seven, Joey, that they repeated over and over. Senator Raphael Warnock on Meet the Press gives an example of it.
Senator Warnock, welcome back to Meet the Press. What was your reaction when you saw him struggling to complete sentences?
Well, listen, if they weren't engaged in a little bit of hand-wringing, they wouldn't be Democrats. And again, maybe it's because I preach every Sunday. Bad debates happen, as President Obama has said. And this was 90 minutes. But let me tell you about that 90 minutes. Donald Trump lied the entire 90 minutes.
5:54. Yeah, that was the response, Tim. But Senator Warnock, the President of the United States is drooling all over the stage and is making up words. But the President Trump lied. He's a liar. He lied about it. But Ms. Senator Warnock, President Biden said that no soldiers died under his watch. Yes, but the President lied. Trump lied, lied. So that was the counter. Trump lied. And there's no other person that can be Donald Trump but Joe Biden. That was the talking points for the Democrats over the weekend, their surrogates. And Tim, from that CBS YouGov poll, I don't think it's convincing many people.
I think they doth protest too much. Look, when you push them, Chris, on explaining what all these lies of President Trump were, they have a really tough time coming up with them because Trump speaks in hyperbole, right? He embellishes. And so he may have embellished a few things here and there, but the seeds of all his arguments were all pretty actually true. Yeah. You know, when he says, okay, so here's an example. Trump will say, the economy really sucks. Inflation is at 1,000,000%. Okay. He'll say that as a colloquialism, like we talk, like it's sky high. How often do we say that, right? Okay, it's not 1,000,000%, but it's historically high. Is that really a lie, or is he really making his point? Whereas what you just said, Biden flat out lied about no servicemen, and these families are sitting at home going, what the hell did he just say?
Yeah, especially our service member here, Jared Schmitz from St. Charles County, who was one of the 13 that was killed at the gate there in Afghanistan. I'm sure Mr. Schmitz was appalled to hear the Commander-in-Chief, President of the United States, flat out lie and say that no soldiers died under his watch. And, you know, Tim, that is, as a president, you take very serious sending our soldiers into harm's way. Yes. And when a soldier dies, I'm sure, you know, after they've sent them there, they take that very seriously. I mean, just look at the fact, how could he either lied or he forgot. And it's like, how in the world can you forget that 13 soldiers in one day died on your watch because of your decisions? Either you lied or you forgot. Either one is ridiculous to me.
And what's worse, they're both terrible, right?
Yeah.
If he lied, what a shame. What a horrible thing to lie about the servicemen and women who have given their life in this country. If he forgot, that's even more terrifying.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, we forgot to ask Jim Talent about this, but we should have asked him, what do our enemies across the world think about our president in the United States? Is making up facts, lying, can't complete sentences? Of course, we'll ask him that next week, because up next is Larry Connors USA. Larry's got some big topics for you. He's going to talk about how the libs are going even more crazy with SCOTUS immunity decision. He's going to talk with J6 attorney Ed Martin on how SCOTUS ruling affects those arrested. And Biden is under attack by fellow Democrats. Larry's going to have all that and more up next, 6 to 8. You have been listening to the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show on 101.9 94.1 News Talk STL. Drive safe.
For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.